Welcome to Luckus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listeners. So please show your support for this amazing community resource by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Transportation is the highest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon, but emissions caused by residential and commercial buildings, including from electricity and natural gas use, are close behind. In 2021, while transportation was responsible for 35% of Oregon's carbon emissions, residential and commercial buildings were responsible for 34%, more than agriculture or industry. This legislative session is considering four bills to reduce the building sector's emissions while also addressing the need to make buildings more resilient in the face of climate chaos. Today we talk with Greer Ryan with Climate Solutions and Anna Molina with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance about the substance of these bills and what it will mean for Oregon if they become law. Anna and Greer, welcome to Luckus Focus.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I want to start by just talking about that figure that I threw out, that 34% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions are coming from the building sector, because I think that surprises a lot of people. How is that possible?
It is surprising, I suppose, that it's so much pollution just from our buildings, where we work, where we live, where we go to school. It's a combination of things. For one, it's emissions from the electricity sector. But our electricity sector is getting cleaner every year. We're on track to get to 100% clean because of a bill that was passed in 2021 called HB 2021. So that's really great. Our electricity sector is cleaning up. But we also have direct fuel use from natural gas, as you said, and other fuels in our buildings as well.
What do you mean by direct use?
Using fuels to heat our homes or to cook. People might know about stoves, of course, but we also use gas furnaces, gas water heaters, things like that.
I guess there's probably less oil furnaces than there used to be. Is that true?
Yeah, I think every year we're moving further and further away from other kinds of fuels, which is good. We need to definitely transition to cleaner, more efficient, and healthier homes, which is why how we heat our homes, how we cook is so important.
So I know that you don't want to get into the specifics about natural gas, but let's talk about why it's a concern that so much of our house heating and water heating and cooking is fueled by natural gas.
Absolutely. Well, gas use, whether it's for electricity or for direct home heating and cooking, is a real problem for the climate. Methane gas is 85-ish% more potent as a climate driver than CO2 is, carbon dioxide. So it's one of the biggest threats we have to our climate right now. It's also gas use in homes and in other buildings is a real public health problem. We know, and more research comes out all the time, that gas use directly correlates with higher rates of childhood asthma, with issues related to cognition, lots of other health harms. So that's a concern. I think that the reason we're here today is to talk about these resilient, efficient buildings bills, this package that we're really, really excited about. And it is fuel neutral. These four bills will allow folks to really get it at energy efficiency savings, reducing their energy use, reducing climate emissions, making their homes healthier and safer. So it's not about what type of fuel it's used per se, but getting at those, energy efficient gains will help us improve our public health, will help us improve safety and reduce climate emissions.
So Anna, how does this resiliency work?
How it works is that by being able to transition to cleaner energy, we'll gain better health, lower cost, and a safer climate by increasing our climate resilience in our homes and buildings. And with more insulation and sturdier windows and doors and transitioning to that clean energy for heating and cooking, will be easier, like Greer was saying, for communities that live in these homes that, the gas from stoves can impact people's health. And so right now, too many of our homes and places that we gather and that we work at put us at risk for the harms of climate change, and the way that we heat and cook from fossil fuels is also making things worse, like Greer was mentioning, and especially for low-income and frontline communities who live in these buildings. So together, these bills are like a holistic approach to both existing and future buildings, and these common sense recommendations that are included in the package that we're supporting will increase the access to safe, affordable, and efficient homes, buildings that reduce expenses like utility bills and protect us all from climate harms. And so again, Oregonians deserve healthy, affordable, and resilient homes and buildings that can run on clean energy.
Well, one of the issues about getting your home more resilient and more airtight, or not maybe airtight, but just more efficient in the way that it's using its the fuel to heat it and do other things or to cool it. But part of the problem, or maybe the big part of the problem, is that it's expensive to do that. And so even though a lot of middle-class people are able to move to heat pumps and induction stoves and other resources that will really both cut their utility bills and also really clean up the atmosphere and their health, it doesn't help, as you're describing, people in low-income frontline communities. So do these bills address that income gap?
I think they do, yes. So they definitely do. Because again, transitioning to an all-electric for new construction, so whether that's like for low-income buildings that get built new, they offer real savings. So whether you're building a detached single-family home or a 900-square-foot multifamily unit, going all-electric is cheaper in all cases, and it lowers the cost of construction by $4,750. And again, over time, this also makes it so that like low-income families don't have to choose whether they decide to pay like really high energy bills or if they're going to pay their rent. And so it allows, like, over time, low-income families to be able to have more, like, disposable income and not be in that low-income status.
Great. Can we start by just running down what these bills are? Because I think it'd be good to just lay them out, and then we can sort of dissect them after that.
Absolutely. So, as you said, there's four bills. There's also a fifth companion bill that we've kind of adopted into the package. So two of them go together. SB 868, which is Healthy Heating and Cooling for All. That one is paired with a partner bill, the ODO, or Oregon Department of Energy One-Stop Shop bill. And those two bills together will make it easier for folks to tap into federal incentives. There's this bill that, or this law that was passed last year by the federal government, the Inflation Reduction Act. And that, along with other programs that already existed, will allow for just millions and millions of dollars, the most money that the federal government has ever invested in climate and clean energy solutions, to come to the states, including Oregon. These bills set up our agencies to better receive that money, better help individual homeowners, renters, business owners to tap into those funds. And they also help to align our state agencies. Basically, we have the Department of Energy, the Health Authority, various other state agencies that all have energy efficiency or resilience programs in one way or another. And these say, hey, Department of Energy, let's help coordinate all of these programs. Let's streamline them, reduce waste, basically get more bang for our buck for every public dollar that's spent on helping to deploy a heat pump or helping to weatherize an older building that's very leaky and allows for instance, wildfire smoke to come in, rather than having that dollar stretched kind of thinly. We can allow for, you know, more and more homes, more folks to be able to benefit from those. And then the final thing that it does that's very, very exciting is sets up a 500,000 heat pump deployment target. You mentioned heat pumps. I'm not sure if everybody knows what they are.
Let's talk about that.
Okay.
We actually reinstalled one last year, right in the middle of this first heat spill we had that summer when our air conditioner died. So when we decided we're going to do a heat pump instead of replacing the air conditioner, every time I mentioned to anybody, they would cheer.
Yeah.
So and there's a growing understanding about what heat pumps are. But for those people who aren't cheering yet, what are they?
I love that people cheer when you tell them that, because I would too. A single tear might go down my face.
Of happiness.
They are just very cool appliances. We've had them for a long time, but they've really kind of made leaps and bounds as far as how efficient they are over time. They move heat around rather than producing it from fuel. So they're much, much more efficient at heating a space than traditional heating options like electric resistance heating or gas furnaces. They also, as you said, cool a space. So they provide both in one appliance. And that is increasingly critical for Oregon homes, as we know. We saw more than 100 people die in the heat wave a couple of summers ago. I didn't have cooling at the time. I also lived in a pretty old rental unit, and I had to leave. I had to go stay with a friend who had better windows, who had cooling, because it was just was unsafe after a point. Yeah. And I know that probably a bunch of folks listening relate to that.
Actually, mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends who live in older houses, same age as our house, but mm-hmm. don't have air conditioning. Yeah. And they were all moving in with relatives or friends who had it. And it gives you an indication of how things have changed, because when we originally got our air conditioning back like 25 years ago, and I was arguing against it. We don't need air conditioning in Oregon. It's only hot 2 weeks out of the year. About 5 years ago, my partner, who was one insisted in getting it, looked at me and said, "Aren't you glad we have air conditioning?"
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a very sad thing, actually. People in Seattle even now are needing air conditioning, and they're a little bit cooler than we are. So I think that as we look at the changes that climate chaos is creating and the needs, it's really helpful that there's something like a heat pump, which makes it much more affordable, actually.
Absolutely.
Now, I will say that heat pumps are a little different than gas furnaces in terms of their heat aspect. And my partner is still not as happy with the heat pump because it doesn't crank out that flame heat, you know, that instant heat. Our cat doesn't sit in front of the registers when we have the heat pump on the way he does when the gas furnace comes on. So I think there's a difference also in like acknowledging that you have to appreciate the differences and maybe have to acclimate to things that you used to really like that aren't there anymore.
Well, to that end, I would say, in addition to having that appliance, that's why it's so important to make sure the rest of your building is efficient and to build from the start very tight envelope buildings, meaning avoid leaks, have good insulation, so that even if you don't have cooling or if you don't want to crank up your heat all winter, you're protected from those intense fluctuations. And you asked about the bills, and I went through the first one, basically.
We've got three more to go, right?
Three more to go. But one of them is build smart from the start. And it's about making sure that our buildings that are constructed in the coming years are done so more efficiently. The governor, Governor Kotek, has a goal that Oregon's going to build 36,000 new housing units every year. That's close to 300,000 new housing units by 2030. So this bill would say Building Codes Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, the agencies that oversee how new construction is constructed, are meant to make sure that the guidelines that we have, the building codes that we have, are in line with our state climate goals, and actually that we can build more resilient from the start.
That seems like a really important issue because we've got these lofty goals, and we've actually had incredible goals here in Portland for many years, which are not mm-hmm. being met. So how will these bills actually make us meet the goals that Oregon espouses?
How they'll make us meet the goals. again, by having standards of like when buildings either have to start reporting their emissions to, again, this like build smart from the start allows to directs the work to be in consultation with like the Oregon Department of Energy. And again, it sets up these efficiency goals for new residential and commercial construction to aim to achieve a 60% reduction in energy consumption from a 2006 baseline by 2030. So again, it's having like those tangible goals that we can see so that we know that we're meeting our standards. And if we're not, then how do we improve it? How do we move forward? How do we get everybody on board?
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Anna Molina with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance and Greer Ryan with Climate Solutions about the substance of some new bills that are before the state legislature here in Oregon right now and what it will mean for Oregon if they become law. So what are these goals specifically, Anna, that they are going to be mandated to meet? And what's the difference between what was there before that was kind of fuzzy and what's going to be in these new bills?
I'll have Greer answer that.
Okay.
Sure, happy to. So one thing that's kind of interesting is that we're not actually changing too much from what the Building Codes Division is already doing. We're aware that they're already doing a lot and that they have these goals in mind from the Governor Brown's executive order 2004. So this is something they've been thinking about and working on. This Build Smart from the Start bill helps to codify or solidify these goals so that they're state law. As Anna said, one of the main goals or one of the main parts of this is a 60% reduction in energy use from a 2006 level by 2030 basically says you have to build more efficiently than you were building in 2006 by 2030. We also, through this bill, are saying Building Codes Division, which the kind of overseeing agency is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, you have to start looking into embodied carbon. That's the emissions or the pollution that comes from building materials. And it's one of the biggest and most important sources of pollution at the point of new construction. So if we can, you know, just by changing some of the ways that we produce, manufacture, transport materials, whether it's wood, whether it's metals, that can have a huge reduction in the emissions for the life cycle of that building. And this is the first time a state law has directed this agency to look into this. So that's very exciting.
So how are they going to figure that out?
Oh, man. That's it's a kind of a potential doozy, right? Because there's so many different things they can look into. So what they're going to do is they're going to have to consult with the Department of Environmental Quality, which has a team that's already been looking at this for years, and some of the best experts in the state. And those two agencies together are going to basically investigate this and come back with findings. So it's flexible. It allows the state agency to, or both state agencies, to do this work without a bunch of additional costs. That's the goal. And hopefully find some kind of low-hanging fruit in the short term for us to implement into our codes, ideally. And
what would this low-hanging fruit be?
Well, that's... I have predictions, of course. We've, you know, there's research out there about certain building materials. I think, you know, it could be concrete, it could be certain kinds of metals. But I'm going to leave
that
to
the... These are things that we should be getting away from, like mm-hmm. concrete.
Or just making sure that they have fewer emissions. Concrete is very climate pollution intensive. So that's one example. But it might be that, you know, we use different wood products for a while, or change the way that we manufacture certain kinds of metals. I don't want to speak before the experts have a chance to investigate this, but that's the kind of thing that they're going to be looking into.
Yeah, there's this building that they built on MLK right near here in KBOO. And I watched it go up a couple years ago, and they didn't use any metal girders. It was all built with wood.
All timber.
And it was very interesting to watch it go up. Once they finished building it, it looked sort of like a normal building, but when I look at it closely, I can still see that underneath the veneer that there's still that wood. And I wonder how much difference would that have made building that building with wood than if they'd used all metal girders?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. I'm not entirely sure, but one of the things that I want to expand upon that Greer was saying with this Build Smart from the Start is that by having new construction and new buildings be energy efficient with no carbon emissions really sets us up for success in the future. Because again, our buildings from 50 years ago were not constructed with climate change in mind. And so now by constructing our buildings with that, we can really help reduce those carbon emissions that we're feeling the impacts of now. Mm-hmm. And so again, it really sets us up to reduce our carbon emissions, to improve people's health who are living in those buildings with this Build Smart from the Start.
Well, one of the things that I think about when you talk about how the buildings that were built 50 years ago were not built very smart, and actually I think maybe starting 50, 60 years ago was one of the worst tendencies in building looking back at housing stock that's much older. I live in a house that was built in 1907, and it's probably far more resilient in spite mm-hmm. of the fact, I mean, we've done a lot. We put in new windows, and we've done insulation where we could. But it's a lot more resilient than these ranch-style houses that have no overhangs. I mean, we have, like, the roof in the older houses overhangs so there'd be shade, so it would keep the house cooler. And they were built better, and they were much more solid. And I'm watching the stuff that's going up now all around town, and I know firsthand from somebody who has a shop in one of the new buildings that just went up in Selwood, that it's like the apartments above her shop are all full of mold and mildew.
Oh, no.
I think I've been hearing a lot of stories about a lot of the new building is like really on the cheap. Mm. So one of the things that it seems to be happening is that building practices are being determined more by greed than they are by understanding resilience. And I wonder if these bills are going to maybe pull back a little bit on the greed factor and get builders to have to comply with doing not just the resilience as far as climate goes, but making their buildings built so that they're healthy to live in and that they're going to last a long time.
I hope that's one of the outcomes. That's definitely what we were aiming for, is to make sure that there, you know, because we know that there are cost-effective solutions to building more sustainably. We have some of the best green builders in the country, in the world, right here in Portland. And some of them were sitting on the legislative task force that developed these bills. Those folks say over and over again that affordable housing can be built efficiently. You can build low cost with just better insulation, better windows, if you plan right from the start and if you have those priorities in mind. I do think that there's obviously some oversight that we need to have to make sure that that happens. That's a big part of why we have these building codes. And then we have, you know, the third bill I wanted to talk about was the building performance standard.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that I think applies here as well. That bill is about the largest buildings, the largest commercial buildings we have in the state, 35,000 square feet and above. So not your average, you know, pizza joint, but the Walmarts or the major skyscrapers that you see here in Portland or elsewhere. Those buildings make up some of the, you know, are some of the biggest polluters, many of the older ones in particular. And a building performance standard, which is a pretty cool policy that's been implemented in a variety of states and is currently being implemented in Washington, just north of us. They basically say building owners who have these really, really large buildings, over time, you have to make your buildings more efficient to meet a certain energy use intensity, which is basically a standard that, depending on the building type, would be set. And if you're already meeting it, great. Nothing, you don't have to do anything. But if you're not meeting it, it's a flexible menu of options of things that you can do to make your building more efficient, whether it's switching out appliances, weatherizing your windows, any number of things. And that bill on its own, I think, has probably the, you know, biggest pollution reduction benefits that we have of this list of bills. But it's really about kind of working with building owners to find those cost-effective solutions to be more efficient. Because, as you said, maybe without these kinds of incentives, without these kinds of policies, they might not choose to do so on their own.
Well, one of the things that concerns me is that there seems to be some obscuring about when we talk about building more affordable housing, that somehow, I think it's the building industry, makes a point of, well, it's all these environmental regulations that we have, which makes it too expensive to build affordable housing. There was a very disturbing story on Oregon Public Broadcasting a couple of weeks ago where they interviewed this builder who had this lot ready to build somewhere close in Northeast Portland where he could put in 10 units. He would have been able to make $35,000 per unit if he didn't have to follow these regulations. But with the regulations, he was only going to make $20,000 per unit. So his net gain was going to be $200,000 instead of $350,000. I weep for him. But I felt like the story also kind of let this guy go. Like, yeah, sure, that shows that it's too expensive to have environmental regulations. So my question is, how do we make sure that those two issues are not combating with each other, and that we are showing how you can build affordably and also maintain the highest environmental standards?
I guess I would say that we have to keep our eye on the prize, which is the people who live in these buildings, who work in these buildings, and the outcomes for communities here in Oregon. I think we shouldn't forget about the many jobs that'll be created through these bills. The benefits, of course, as we're building more housing, we need that. We have a housing crisis, so we'll need to construct a lot more. I think that will be true for decades. But building better from the start, as we've, you know, said a few times now, is really about the benefits that are kind of long term as folks are living in these buildings, to be able to afford their energy bills year after year, to not have to scrimp on paying for medicine or food or daycare or any number of other things that people struggle to pay for month to month because their energy bills are, you know, 10% of their income. That shouldn't be the case. So I think, you know, we're going to have a balance here. The thing I'm really excited about for these bills is that it's, you know, it's, and we probably will talk about this a bit more, but it's a tight budget year for Oregon. And it's really hard to say, you know, invest a lot in these, but we have these bills that are basically for every, you know, dollar that you invest, you're going to get a lot more out of it because of all the federal money coming through. And that's true for builders as well. There's a lot of money available to construct more efficiently. And I think maybe what historically they faced as far as like higher costs for, you know, potential upgrades won't be as much of a won't be as much of the case moving forward because of these incentives, because of these carrots that are available.
Well, some of the issues I think about the this particular builder that he was objecting to weren't so much resilience issues. Well, they were resilience, but like mandating green roofs, which I don't know that they really cost more. I think it's just a change of your mindset.
Right.
Bird safe windows, which I can't believe cost that much more. Bicycle parking, planting trees. And I'm wondering if the legislation that's being proposed is going to include those issues or if it's just about what's going into the building itself.
It depends on the bill, I guess, because, yeah, some of it's going to be figured out in rules.
Yes.
And so that basically means agencies have some decision making about what things might be considered more efficient. But yeah, Anna was right.
Obviously, having trees is one of the best ways of cooling and also of carbon capture. So I just don't understand why that sort of is, why there's a force moving in Oregon to sort of pull back on some of these really good regulations that we already have.
I know, it's dangerous because we also, you know, every bit of climate pollution that we're releasing now or not mitigating now, it's going to have, you know, worse and worse consequences moving forward. So we really need the pollution reduction that we do now is much more important than 10 years from now, right? It's a very urgent thing. So it's extremely stressful that we're facing opposition for our basic climate and environmental regulations when we need them the most. And they really are about just kind of protecting folks from fundamental harms.
Yeah, because again, building resilient energy efficient buildings and homes also requires like significantly less energy to be heated and cooling, and again reduces the energy cost. So that's like what we're really looking at, and building with energy efficiency and resilient homes can offer real savings, like we were saying, to the people who live in them and also to the builders, of like avoiding costly hookups and reducing the number of appliances that are used for heating and cooling. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you'll have like one appliance needed to heat and cool your home or building and not all these other costly hookups that can really impact the price.
So how is this bill going to effectively make sure that this happens? Because it does seem, I guess what I'm wondering actually is how much pushback is this bill getting from the builders and the developers?
Well, fortunately, not a lot so far. We had such a diverse group of folks at the table for the Resilient Efficient Buildings Task Force, which was a nearly year-long process with 27 members, that these bills were developed to be flexible, to make sure that cost-effective solutions are prioritized. And so we've gotten almost unanimous positive support. There was a really beautiful hearing that happened a couple months ago, where you just got to hear, you know, testimony after testimony of people talking about how this will benefit them, in either in their work or in their personal lives. We, of course, are aware that there's always some pushback to anything, you know. So we're definitely doing our diligent kind of work behind the scenes to make sure that folks have answers to that, to make sure that policymakers understand what these bills do and don't do. And then so much of the details will be developed over time with experts and the agencies themselves who will be running these programs as they're kind of brought to life.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KPRU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Greer Ryan with Climate Solutions and Anna Molina with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance about the substance of these bills and what it will mean for Oregon if they become law. Well, what happens if the Republicans don't come back into the Senate? I mean, just in case people don't know what I'm talking about, at 4 days, the Republicans, not all of them, but enough of the Republican senators in the Oregon Senate have stayed away from session so that they can't move forward because they don't have a quorum.
Yeah, it's you know, this has been an issue for Oregon for a long time with certain policymakers walking out in order to avoid having to vote on bills that they would lose on. This year it seems to be about a variety of issues that are fundamental to, you know, personal, public health, reproductive justice, housing, all of these things that are critical. I'm hopeful that our leadership is keeping an eye on this and has a plan. And I, from what I understand from people who know more about this stuff than I do, there is a plan to hold legislators accountable. But folks need to speak up, say this is critical, especially if you live in a district where your representative or senator is considering walking out or has walked out. Let them know that they have to do their job.
It's like they were voted for a reason, to do this job, to make sure that the constituents' voices are heard. And so by walking out, they're not listening to their constituents, and they're not being held accountable for the job that they were placed to do. So again, like Gree was saying, again, emailing legislators, making phone calls to let them know, like, hey, you have to do your job, get back to your office, will be really critical because, again, hopefully legislators listen to that.
Well, I was talking to a friend who knows more about this than I do, and I said, well, I thought we passed some kind of law where they can't run away anymore. She says, well, it's a 10-day absence, so we've got 6 more days, and then I guess they get really severely penalized. But it seems like there's not a whole lot of teeth to that last bill that was passed that was supposed to stop the Republicans from leaving the Senate or the House.
I hope the teeth work to prevent this from derailing the entire session. We still have some time. We have, 6 or so weeks left. So
it's better than them doing this in June.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that the main issues for the people who are walking out of the Senate right now is abortion and gender education and health, and also gun control. Mm-hmm. Are these housing resilience bills in their sights too, or is this just going to be collateral damage?
That's too hard to say right now, because our bills are currently in the Joint Ways and Means Committee, so that's where they're figuring out the budget, and so there hasn't been like a hearing. It'll get assigned to a subcommittee in the next upcoming weeks, we hope. And so, like, once it gets there, we'll be impacted. But for right now, we're in the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and that's where our bills are currently at.
And I counted four bills, or five maybe, that you're talking about. So I think we still have one more to go.
We do. It's SB 871, or Smart State Buildings. And, you know, when we were developing this package, some of the task force members spoke up pretty regularly about wanting to see leadership from our state itself. Lead by example. If you're asking others to do this, you should too. State buildings would be subject to the building performance standard if they meet the thresholds to trigger those requirements. But they also have some barriers in place that were figured out as far as accessing the same kinds of financing options that private sector buildings can access. So this bill is basically to kind of reduce those barriers, make it easier for the state government to retrofit and make their existing buildings more efficient. I want to say, importantly, the building performance standard that sets these requirements for these big buildings to be more efficient doesn't apply to historic buildings. There's all sorts of exemptions for buildings that where it would be too cost prohibitive to make those changes. Schools and hospitals, multifamily buildings wouldn't be subject to this. So it's really about those like big polluting large commercial buildings.
So how much more stringent is that than the buildings that you're saying wouldn't apply to?
So the ones where it doesn't apply basically have to report. So multifamily, apartment buildings that are really, really large, universities, hospitals, those buildings have to start benchmarking their energy use and reporting it. They can also access voluntary incentives if they choose to meet those standards and make improvements to do so. But the idea was there needs to be more process, needs to be more kind of workshopping with communities that will be affected for these like special energy use building types before any kind of requirement is put on them. So hopefully the Department of Energy will use this process to learn more about those kinds of buildings, to work with communities that are affected, and to help them make improvements over time without it being something that is, harmful in some inadvertent, unanticipated way.
Well, some of the buildings that have some of the most serious lack of resilience problems are schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure there's very many schools in the Portland area, let alone the state, that are air conditioned.
Right.
So is there any movement to address that issue, which I think is really critical?
There is a bill, actually, that's not part of this package, but we are supportive of, or Climate Solutions is, that is about improving the HVAC, that's the heating and ventilation and air conditioning systems that go into schools. And that's being led by a really great coalition, including some labor unions, to make sure that the indoor air quality of schools is improved as we make them more energy efficient and help to upgrade to, you know, better solutions like heat pumps for cooling. So we're excited about that, but it's just kind of a separate process from this package.
And also, a lot of these buildings are really very leaky.
Yes.
And I think about the school that I went to when I was a kid. This is back in the 50s and early 60s, and huge windows, which mm-hmm. I'm sure were just massive leaks. But that was back in the days before we thought about that stuff.
Right, and it was maybe before the climate harms were so intense where we had to quite as much here in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, what about old houses? Since I live in one of these old houses, and it's very hard. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we can't do with our house. Like, we can't fully insulate it because of the way that it's built with shiplap, and you have to take all the siding off in order to do proper insulation. So when we have replaced siding, we've insulated, but that's mm-hmm. a small part of it. What do we do with all these houses? Because I think still, like, the largest amount of Oregon housing stock is older houses. I mean, a lot older than 1950.
Right. That's a huge challenge. We, for one, know that a lot of those older houses are heated by electric resistance heating, which is relatively inefficient. So this heat pump deployment goal, we hope, will help to replace some of those electric resistance heating homes with heat pumps so that they can have both heating and cooling, and it can be more energy efficient even in a older house than if they had that electric resistance heating alone and then tried to put window air conditioning units or something up, right? So that's a big part of what we're trying to do here. I can't probably say this enough, that this is kind of a once in a generation moment for federal dollars to come through to help single family homeowners, business owners, others, tap into rebates and incentives to make these kinds of upgrades more affordable. And we're really hopeful we'll really ramp up job creation as well. But the truth is, it's harder to make these retrofits to an older building than it is to just construct correctly from the start, to have it be, have this new housing be energy efficient, which is why we want the two-pronged approach of upgrades to existing homes, make them easier to access, still voluntary, but more affordable, and then to make sure that our new buildings are tighter and better.
Now, you mentioned 500,000 heat pumps is mm-hmm. the goal. How are these heat pumps going to be deployed, and how much would they cost homeowners?
So this is a goal for the state, and there's a lot of flexibility with it. The Department of Energy will have to start basically looking into, well, where are we at? How hard would it be to reach that goal in different types of buildings? And, the big thing that we think this will help do is spur heat pump deployment for the new construction. If we're getting, 300,000 something buildings in a decade, I guess if it's 36,000 per year over 10 years, it's 360,000 new homes. That's a lot of potential to help meet that goal. But we also are looking at, 40%, give or take, of our existing homes are heated with electric resistance heating, very inefficient. If some portion of that, half of that, were replaced with heat pumps, another couple hundred thousand. So I think it's going to be very doable, but it's ambitious. And it's up to the Department of Energy and other agencies to kind of make sure that folks are able to easily access state and federal dollars to do that. It's up to the state to say, where we have the opportunity to upgrade our own buildings, we're going to put in heat pumps. As we work to develop this building performance standard, heat pumps will, I'm sure, be on the table for that flexible menu of options for building owners to get points.
Now, how is this going to be made available and accessible to low-income people?
The big thing there is stacking of resources, making sure that folks who are lower income, we have really great existing state programs that were developed through legislation over the last couple of years to help with that. One is Healthy Homes is the bill. And if we're able to help boost Healthy Homes, put some more money into that, which allows for whole home retrofits for low-income folks in particular, As we have the Portland Clean Energy Fund, which is already in, you know, in the works, already doing great to get a bunch of money out the door for folks to install heat pumps. Those kinds of programs collectively, especially when community groups get involved to help deploy those funds to the people who need them the most, can help either like homeowners and business owners, but low-income folks in particular, access those heat pumps for low to no cost. And then the federal incentives in particular are designed to help lower income homeowners get those appliances at low to no cost. So that's the goal.
So yeah. What about people who are middle income but still don't have that much disposable income? Because they probably fall out of the realm of what's available for low income people.
Moderate income folks also have bigger or more incentive pots available to them than higher income folks do. So that's good. And I think that I know the way that we've designed these bills are specifically designed so that in rulemaking with the agencies, lower income and moderate income folks will be prioritized, as well as environmental justice communities and others. And Anna, I'm sorry, I think you might have wanted to add something there.
Oh, no, I was just going to say when you were talking about the federal government's Inflation Reduction Act that these bills can leverage, the lower income households qualify to have like 100% of a heat pump covered up to like $8,000. So again, these are leveraging these federal funds to really be able to help lower income communities access those.
That's still like our heat pump was a little over $12,000, and I understand that they've gone up since last summer. And so, I mean, $8,000 is a great help, but if you're still having to pay $4,000 to $6,000, that could still be really a non-starter for people who are on technically low income, but mm-hmm. still, especially these days when everything's costing more, that somebody who would be considered moderate income is going to find that to be a stretch. So I wonder if there's any more that can be done to make these appliances more available to people.
There's always more that can be done is mm-hmm. the real answer.
But will it get done?
I mean, that's why the setting up these bills right now is so important to help flow this money through. But also, we need to push our legislators to invest in these funds. As you know, it's a tight budget year where we're facing a lot of pushback for spending a lot of money on these things. But I think the message of the climate can't wait. We can't wait to invest in these solutions, these clean energy solutions that actually have a very real, you know, sometimes life or death impact on households and communities. And the more that we invest now to actually make these solutions available to, you know, everyday Oregonians, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, because again, like the expenses will only get more expensive if we don't take the time to invest in them now. Like climate change isn't gonna stop anytime soon. We're gonna have more heat waves, more ice storms, and if we're not making that investment now, are the ones who will pay the price for that are low income Oregonians across the state.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KVU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCVB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Anna Molina, who's with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, and Greer Ryan with Climate Solutions, about substance of 4 to 5 new bills that are being proposed right now in the current legislative session and what it will mean to Oregon if they become law. Well, Anna, your organization is called the Oregon Just Transition Alliance.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about what that whole concept of just transition is about and why, as the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, you're involved in working for these bills.
Yeah, so my organization, the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, we are a movement of communities facing environmental racism, climate change, and economic exploitation. And so we're at the front lines of injustice and at the front line of change. And so our alliance brings together organizations committed to base building and frontline communities to create ownership over our collective future and move Oregon towards an economy that is rooted in our shared values and the principles of a just transition. We, Kiri had mentioned and talked about HB 2021. For the past couple of years, we've been working with our community, with our alliance on building resilience, like throughout in our communities. So in 2021, we were part of the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign that passed bills to support low-income families to weatherize their homes, to transition off of fossil fuels, and to move our state to transition to clean energy. And then in 2022, we supported the heat pump deployment bill as well. So that's why we're invested in this. We've seen the heat wave that took the lives of Oregonians across the state. We've seen wildfires ravage our member organizations, communities in Southern Oregon. We've seen our alliance members jump up and support their communities. And so this is important for us because we're, our communities are here and we need to weather the storm, and not everybody has the same opportunities. And so we have to invest in our in low-income BIPOC communities to make sure that they're prepared for the next disaster.
Well, we've been hearing more and more of this term, just transition, but I think a lot of people might not really know what it means. So how would you define what a just transition is?
For me, a just transition means moving away from an extractive economy that is extractive of people's labor, of our resources, and moves to an economy that's regenerative, that really supports the needs of communities, not just a few, and that we're making intentional choices of like how we're building our new buildings, and that again creates a new world where everybody has what they need, and that our environment and climate support life.
Because I see it too. It's like moving away from a model where just a few benefit on the backs of everybody else, and largely people of color and low-income people, to the point where not only do the communities that have been marginalized historically start to benefit too, but they also are involved in actually making decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of a just transition is that deep democracy, that everybody has a say in what will happen in their communities and has a say in what they want to see in their communities. And that's also like a very deep principle of like environmental justice as well, that the folks who are most impacted are also in those conversations where those decisions are making, where those decisions are being made and have an influence and impact of and can shape that.
Well, speaking of democracy, how do you see, what is your prognosis for these bills passing?
So we don't have any kind of like magic crystal ball to predict, but I think we're feeling really, really optimistic. The big barriers, of course, are as I've said, budget, are just general democracy issues of the state legislature right now.
But meaning Republicans leaving the campus.
Exactly. But we feel very, very good about these bills themselves and about the process that went into them. We feel like our leadership on these bills, Senate Majority Leader Kate Lieber, Representative Pam Marsh, among others, are just really strong champions of these bills, and we're so grateful for that. So the most important thing is right now they need to hear in the Ways and Means Committee and in leadership generally at the legislature that this is critical to pass this year, that this can't wait, and that they need to be adequately funded. So that means spending the money now so that we can see the benefits sooner. It doesn't mean putting money away and frittering it away for future years and not spending any money now. So that's the big message.
That's kind of happened in the past, hasn't it?
Sure has. And I think that's one of the threats, is that these bills won't get over the finish line, not because they're not good policy, not because they don't have clear benefits, but because policymakers don't want to spend any money right now. And we really risk missing out on huge federal opportunities if that happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the beginning of the session, I was really excited by, it seemed like a huge rash of climate bills, and not just climate bills, environmental bills, a lot of, and all kinds of justice bills. And I mean, whether it's the right to repair or whether it's a whole bunch of other things that are on the table. And then I started hearing about these anti-environment, anti-democracy bills that are also on the table. And I'm wondering how you see, are you familiar at all what now is going on with the legislature to know how these things are shaking out?
Yeah, a bit, for sure. I think we saw a lot of bills. This was a very bill-heavy year, thousands
like 5,
of bills.
Or something like that.
It was a lot.
It was also a year where some of the bills didn't get introduced until partway through session. And that doesn't mean those bills won't come back next year or the year after. I think some we're still hopeful that many of the environmental bills will have a second life next year. But it's disappointing because we don't have much time. We need across-the-board solutions. Buildings are, as you laid out at the top, a critical priority because they make up the second highest polluting sector in the state, because they are our first line of defense against climate harms. But that's just one piece of the bigger puzzle of solutions that we need. There's been a lot of industry opposition to some of the climate priorities that we've had. We have some of our biggest polluters in the state that are currently taking legal action against the Climate Protection Program, which is a landmark policy that we have. They want to roll it back.
Northwest Natural is one of the leaders in that, I understand.
They are. Northwest Natural, for those who don't know, is the state's largest gas utility and one of the biggest fossil fuel companies in the state. And we're seeing this across the country with gas companies and other fossil fuel corporations trying to roll back climate protections, trying to prevent public health solutions to fossil fuels. And that's really definitely getting in the way of climate progress and just equity solutions that we need.
Well, before we went on the air, you were talking about how much better some other states are doing than Oregon is right now. So let's talk about the difference between what's happening in the state legislatures in Washington and California and New York State compared to what's happening here in Oregon.
Well, absolutely. There are states that are ahead of us on climate, and we need these bills to help us get a little bit closer to where our neighbors, Washington and California, are on climate, on buildings in particular. California already has a state heat pump goal that is proportional to the one that we would be passing with healthy heating and cooling for all. Washington State has much stronger building codes that allow for basically only heat pumps to be installed moving forward. In New York State is left and right pushing for energy efficiency and building electrification. A lot of that has to do with really, really great activists in those states who are pushing for these solutions and communities that are deeply involved. I think Oregon's going to get there.
We have great activists, but what's happening?
I think we'll get there. I think we're in a tight spot with money, and just the mechanism of our legislature is a little different, but it's time for us to catch up, and our leaders need to hear that.
Well, one of the things I hope is that somewhere before the next legislative session, they're going to make it illegal for legislators to leave the campus and to completely gum up the works, or to better still get rid of the supermajority rule.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what the solution is there, because it's tough. You know, we also want legislators to be safe. And there are, concerns around that. But I do want to stop seeing these walkouts, because it's ridiculous that our state leaders can just not do their job and get away with that year to year.
Yeah, and part of that solution is also, how do we elect officials that represent the communities we're from? And how do we make sure that people who are in an office are going to be held accountable to the policies that their constituents want them to make? So again, it's also investing in new leaders that are coming from our communities that are Black, Indigenous, and I know we've seen a big upsurge of people taking those offices. So again, it's investing in that leadership so that we can see it represented in our legislature.
Well, we will have a new city government in Portland in a year and a half, and I hope that that's going to help things. Maybe we need to do some thinking at the state level about how we kind of reorganize things there.
Maybe. I think what we definitely need, as Anna said, is more representation. We also need people who are going to stick to being climate leaders. It's been hard to witness some of our best environmental champions not necessarily be super strong on climate. So we need that, and I'm glad that we have so many younger, newer legislators coming through. I hope that continues.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anna and Greer, it's great to have you on. Thanks for being on Locus Focus, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
We've been talking with Greer Ryan with Climate Solutions and Anna Molina with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance. And you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle Station's KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are still doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible as we climb out of this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Lauren Goldberg with Columbia Riverkeeper about Golden Gale Pump Storage. We'll go out with a tune that I wrote. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Living in a land of rainbows, searching for the rainbow's end. Drenched dreams glisten in the sunlight that flickers only now and then. Sodden streams of sorrow fall like rain. But leaflets strewn in puddles can't explain a moment's grace that fills the air, spreading lightness that can overcome despair. The hopes and dreams and plans we schemed when we were young evaporate as time grows long and life seems short. Sometimes it seems that what we have is all we'll ever get. But what I knew so well when I was young has stayed with me too long to now forget. See my dreams in windows etched with rain, reflecting what I know but cannot name. As time spreads wide its wings and draws a sigh, I feel the hope that I'll learn to fly. I'll learn to fly. Etched with rain.